Thank you for the invitation to speak here today. When Wilma first contacted me about participating in this symposium, I readily accepted because as a non-academic, I'm a Forest Service scientist. It's rare that I get the opportunity to speak to students. And then shortly thereafter, I contacted her and said, well, really, what do you want from me? And I think maybe we just heard a little bit about it. But she said simply, tell us who you are, perhaps why you're here, what opportunities are there in the Forest Service for entomologists, and provide some suggestions for student or early career professional development. And that's what I hope to accomplish here today, concentrating primarily on the latter than the former. Just a very brief introduction about myself. I got my start in this business while working as a research technician back in forestry school. And that part leading to my master's thesis, which I completed at Virginia Tech back in 1996, where we looked at a complex of two weevils, Hylobius pales and Pisodes nemerensis, two pretty common regeneration pests, and their ability to vector a root pathogen in white pine Christmas tree plantations. And we also looked at how the root disease was manifested in individual hosts and within plantations themselves. And from there, I quickly went over to the University of Georgia. I was a colleague of Mike's at the time. He was also there. And I worked in what we were calling at the time intensive culture, simply how quickly can you grow trees, in this case loblolly pine, in order to meet our fiber needs, and what are the ramifications to the pest complexes that are associated with that host. Specifically, I spent the majority of my time working out the phenology for the southeastern United States for this insect here known as the Nantucket pine titmoth, again, a very common regeneration insect. And then I later used that basic information to develop timing models for chemical control within intensive culture plantations. From there, I had a very short postdoc at the Savannah River site in association with the University of Georgia, looking at the ecology and management of longleaf pine systems, primarily looking at different silvicultural treatments, things like the application of prescribed fire or thinning or a combination of thereof, and their effects on forest health, things like the amount and distribution of bark beetle-caused tree mortality at different spatial and temporal scales. And then I joined the Forest Service in 2001 as a research entomologist and have served in that capacity ever since. Just a little introduction to the Forest Service. I know most of you are aware of Smokey the Bear, but we're much more than Smokey the Bear. We were established back in 1905 as an agency within the USDA, and in fact, we are the largest agency within the department, an annual budget of about $4 billion, and we manage 193 million acres of forest and grassland throughout the United States, the majority of which is obviously in the western United States. Our mission, quite simply, to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of our nation's forests and grasslands to meet the needs of present as well as future generations. Perhaps put more simply and more eloquently by our first chief, Gifford Pinchot, who later went on to be the governor of the state of Pennsylvania, to provide the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of people in the long run. And really, that's what we attempt to accomplish. And we do that within three branches of the agency. The first would be the National Forest System. That's the one you may be familiar with when you go recreate on a national forest. Those are the individuals that are responsible for managing it. But we do have two other branches, the first being state and private forestry, and the second R&D, research and development. And the Forest Service utilizes entomologists within both those latter two branches, so there are opportunities there for students today. I'm part of R&D. We're the largest forest research organization in the world, about 500 scientists now nationwide working in all different types of subdisciplines. We're a national and international leader in forest conservation at several different scales. We have research entomologists within the R&D branch. The number has been shrinking. We're down to about 24 now nationwide. And we really provide two services to the agency. The development of basic knowledge on the ecology of insects and their influence on forest ecosystems, as well as the development of applied knowledge and actual tools to manage forest pests and then to restore impacted landscapes. I mentioned that we also utilize entomologists in state and private forestry, specifically in forest health protection. They're a much larger group. There's about 250 specialists nationwide trained in various aspects of entomology, pathology, things like pesticide use, detection and survey. And then we actually have a very small group that's responsible for technology development of tools that have such a small minor market that perhaps we're the only one that can actually generate them, because it wouldn't be economically feasible for a company to do so. But in a nutshell, really, their primary role is to provide technical assistance on forest health related issues, particularly native and non-native insects. Analogous to the university system, they kind of serve as the extension branch of the USDA Forest Service. But there are opportunities again there for students, and perhaps more opportunities than there are now in research and development. So as I indicated, I'm a research entomologist, have been since 2001. All our scientists work under a personal research assignment. This is mine, three facets. The first is to determine the short and long-term implications to forest health of silvicultural treatments. That those are things like prescribed fire, thinning, harvesting of trees, used in the restoration of fire-adapted forest ecosystems. And then secondly, to develop chemical, silvicultural, and semiochemical-based monitoring and management techniques for western bark beetles. And then finally, to determine the role of semiochemicals in the behaviors of western bark beetles. And I primarily concentrate on areas 1 and 2, maybe spend about 80% of my time working in those two areas. So what I'd like to do is quickly change gears here and use that brief introduction and the lessons that I've learned while serving in those capacities to make some recommendations for student and early career development. First thing that you need to do is surround yourself with important and influential people. And what that comes down to in our discipline is making sure you pick the correct mentors, those that are productive, influential, well-respected, and caring. And I've been particularly lucky in this regard. I joined Scott Salem's lab to do my master's work at Virginia Tech, as I indicated earlier. And at that point in time, Scott was a very young, eager, ambitious professor, and I found his enthusiasm kind of contagious. He's since gone on to become the national leader in biocontrol within forest systems. Secondly, here's Wayne Beresford. Wayne's in the back of the room. When I joined Wayne's lab at the University of Georgia in 1996, he was perhaps the most influential forest entomologist in North America. And by becoming part of his lab and part of his group, I inherited access to individuals that I never would have otherwise. And then finally, when I joined PSW, my first supervisor was Mike Haverty, and his expertise is not off-road driving. He's actually in the back of the room also. And actually, our scientific training and interests are quite different, but what I learned from Mike was how to succeed within Forest Service R&D, because our system is quite different than that of academia where I had spent all my previous career. I was very pleased to hear from Mike all the undergraduate research that's going on at the University of Arizona, because I think as a student, this is one of the single most important things you can do. Start early. I did that. I did undergraduate research at Virginia Tech. It resulted in my first publication in 1996, where we looked at natural products as antifeedants for that regeneration weevil I mentioned earlier, as well as fungitoxin for Leptographium procerum, which is the causal agent of that root disease I previously mentioned. Step up into leadership roles when the opportunities present themselves, even if you lack the confidence. When I joined PSW, shortly thereafter, I was asked to serve as one of six discipline leaders for the fire and fire surrogate study, and I realized probably nobody in this room is familiar with that study, but it is the largest of its kind, funded initially to the tune of about $24 million. I thought that request was premature and that I was perhaps too inexperienced, but I did it. And then shortly thereafter, when both Forest Science and Forest Ecology and Management, two of our premier journals, asked me to serve on their editorial teams, again, I thought maybe the request was premature and that I was too inexperienced, but I did it. And then finally, when the leadership from the three Western research stations asked me to get involved in organizing our research entomologists in the West under a single ad hoc umbrella organization, and I was the youngest member of that community, I was intimidated. I thought perhaps the request was premature, but I did it. And then finally here, when some gray literature came out that the agency was quite concerned about, they were concerned perhaps it would challenge a lot of the things we're doing and get us tied up in a lot of court cases, the request came from Washington to see if I would be interested in putting together an ambitious, unbiased team to actually do a holistic review of that literature, a synthesis, if you will. And I was eager to do it. But at that time, my station director was actually concerned. Perhaps I was a little too green. Perhaps if I got involved in doing so, I would be spending the rest of my career providing testimony inside courtrooms. But that hasn't happened, and we've been successful, and I've yet to see the inside of a courtroom, at least in an official capacity. Be in the right place at the right time, but you also need to be relevant. And some of this happens by coincidence and some by design. Shortly after I joined the Forest Service, they published a report saying we had greater than 200 million acres at risk to either catastrophic wildfire and or large-scale insect and disease outbreaks. And in fact, they were right. You can see here, this is the total acres burned over the last several years. Just astronomical numbers here. And in fact, you can see that in general, we're looking at almost now three times the 20-year average of about 2.8 million acres burned. In terms of bark beetles, well, in general, we've also seen unprecedented levels of bark beetle-caused tree mortality on the forested landscape. And in fact, if we consider the data, I can come up with at least three cases in which we have champions, infestations for which we've never experienced this the severity and longevity and impact in recorded history. And these are those four examples. And in fact, some of these are absolutely incredible. This is a picture I took while working up in British Columbia. This is mountain pine beetle, one of our common tree-killing bark beetles, doing its job in lodgepole pine systems in central British Columbia. This infestation is 22 million acres in size. Just absolutely incredible. And has a, you know, incredible impact, not only on the ecology of those systems, but also on the economics of those communities. That was coincidence. That was, you know, I was there in the right place at the right time. I had legitimate authority to be involved in working in those areas. But in some cases, we've created it. When the Healthy Forest Restoration Act of 2003 passed Congress, like we thought it would, it called for, among many other things, hazardous fuel reduction treatments, trying to reduce the ability of fire to initiate in stands through a series of different types of treatments on a lot of acres, most of that in the west. But it also specified that most of it had to be done in the wild urban land interface. And for those of you not familiar with that term, that's where trees and homes meet. So we thought, as a result of that, we're going to be doing things a little bit differently and got involved in looking at some of the different techniques and their effects on forest health and got out there ahead of the curve, again, making ourselves relevant and being in the right place at the right time by design. And here's just a case where we looked at one of these new treatments, which is chipping, where you reduce a lot of the small trees, chip them, left them on site, and as a result, bark beetles were becoming attracted to these areas and attacking a lot of the residual leaf trees. And there were things we later were able to develop to do something about that. But in many cases, we also like to answer the question, why? Why is this happening? And we achieved this through the use of chemical ecology, and what we showed through this bioassay here was that it was the tremendous amount of monoterpenes that were coming off these newly treated areas that were preferentially attracting certain bark beetle species to those areas, and then they were attacking the residual leaf tree. So again, making yourself relevant there, anticipating those needs. As the agency starts to use prescribed fire more and more as a tool, particularly in ponderosa pine systems, where they're hoping to preserve these large diameter ponderosa pine on the landscape, we started to get involved and look at the actual effects of prescribed fire on these individual trees, the trees we're hoping to maintain on the landscape. And at least in one of our studies, what we found is the application of prescribed fire is actually exacerbating the amount of tree mortality that's occurring in these larger diameter classes. For example, all these large blue blotches in the top portion here are actually large diameter ponderosa pine that have died as a result of bark beetle attack due to the interaction between host vigor and prescribed fire effects, particularly to the fine root system. And then when a certain chemical company was out there making some pretty ambitious claims about the efficacy of some of their new products, we got involved and partnered with Forest Health Protection and actually looked at it and generated the data. And in this specific case, we found out that their product was no more efficacious than the few others that are available to us, making yourself relevant. And then finally, I'll just conclude with the recent IPCC report and climate change research becoming a priority within the agency. We've just started to get involved in this area. And I don't want to suggest to you that you need to be a chameleon and constantly reinventing yourself, but you do need to look and take advantage of the opportunities that are out there, because we all have expertise that is relevant to a lot larger discipline or larger and more disciplines than perhaps we realize. Establish sound productive relationships with your peers, your colleagues, and your clientele. And it's really important to figure out who your clientele is, how they change over time, and what needs they actually might have. And like with any relationship in life, it's not a one shot in the arm. You need to continually nurture and culture these relationships over time. And when you do so, you'll reap quite a few benefits from them. Determine your short, mid, and long-term professional goals. Determine how you get there and proceed accordingly. When I first joined PSW, I had left the University of Georgia, and when I got to what was the economy in Northern California at the time, I was scared to hell. The average home price in the town I lived in was something like $400,000. Housing prices were increasing at 25% a year. I needed to move through the agency as quickly as possible to be able to compete. And that's one of the places that Dr. Haverty came in. I asked him, what do I need to do in terms of moving through the ranks? And he said, at this stage in your career, your currency, perhaps like we just heard, was publishing. Publish, publish, publish. And that's what I did, and I was able to move through the ranks within the agency rather quickly. Now, as I'm beginning to enter perhaps the early part of my mid-career, my goals have changed, and the way I'm going to get there is going to have to change accordingly. But you need to be aware of that. Complete the circle. There's a lot of productive scientists out there, many of them you don't know, because in my opinion, they don't complete the circle. And what that means is giving back in terms of service to your science, perhaps like we're doing here today, as well as service to your agency. Productivity is important, but not in isolation. You need to deliver. It comes down to something that simple. If you can do what you say you're going to do by when you say you're going to do it, on average, you're about 90% ahead of the rest of the competition. And life, in many cases, is simply that simple. And if you can become the go-to person because you've developed that reputation as the one that will deliver as to what you've promised, you just, again, keep fostering these relationships, and you become the go-to person. And the requests come to you, the ideas come to you, and often, therefore, the non-competitive funding will end up in your lap because you've demonstrated you're the one that can deliver, and perhaps a few of your colleagues cannot. In terms of grants, and perhaps all aspects, very important to know the literature. Be current, know what's out there, know what's coming down the pipeline. Remember that the questions, which often show a higher level of thinking, are, on average, probably more important than the answers themselves. A little preliminary data goes a long way in tracking new monies and avoiding embarrassments. And what I mean here is if you can show that you've done a little work, you have a little preliminary data, you've worked out the methodologies and you know and you're able to show that they are likely to be successful on a larger scale, that's going to go a long way when your proposals are being evaluated. And then finally, I just put apply early and often. And what I mean there is don't get discouraged. You put a good grant together, it doesn't get funding, you have the reviews, revise it and resubmit it. And eventually, in most cases, it will be funded. Market and promote. And I know as scientists in general, we're very uncomfortable with this. If we weren't, we would probably be working in the private sector for some large corporation. But in my opinion, it is an important evil. We need to market ourselves, our science, and also our agency. Tell your story. Tell people why you're relevant. Why is your science important? Why they should be interested in contributing it to it. These are pretty important things. I'm also kind of often say awards beget awards, and I believe one of the reasons I was invited here to participate today is because I was recently honored by the president receiving one of these presidential early career awards for scientists and engineers. And the likely reason I won that award is because I had won USDA level awards. And I won USDA level awards likely because I won agency level awards. And I won agency level awards because I had received some awards in academia. But these things kind of just build on themselves. Why are they important? Well, first of all, they help you to promote yourself and your science. but they also provide you access, and they also therefore are going to provide you new lines of funding in which to do your research. And I'd just like to conclude introducing you the folks that are currently working for me. As I said earlier, you need to surround yourself with the right people. This is Bob Boris, Chris Danby, Maria Patterson, as well as Steve McKelvey. These individuals make up my laboratory, although Maria has actually gone back to school to pursue a geology degree at the University of Reno. This is my daughter here quite a few years ago. She's now 4.5 years old. But the reason she's here is to remind me to tell you that our science is important, but there's other things in life that we do that are much more important, and you need to maintain some level of balance in your life. Thank you.